control both political parties. Well, Michael, thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Dr. Stan, it's an honor to be with you again. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's of course, I hear I'm going to quit talking. I'm going to let our listeners find out.
Well, you keep talking. You're doing good.
Well, basically, I want you to tell our listeners why you want to run for the presidency, why you think it's worthwhile putting the time and effort and funding that you are into this race when it appears, that you're not going to get much of any coverage at all from the controlled media.
Well, that's true, Dr. Stan. I think if I had to sum it up in just a couple of words, I have to be careful how I say this, but it's because I'm pro-choice, okay? And what I mean by that, of course, is I am very anti-abortion, but what I mean by that is America needs a real choice here. And as you correctly point out, what we call the two-party system really isn't a two-party system at all. With respect to every major presuppositional issue and point, but the two parties, for all intents and purposes, have merged into one party. We don't really have a two-party system. We think of the odds against having two presidential candidates that are both went to Yale, both members of Skull and Bones. I mean, you really have to. I don't know if anybody's actually done the odds on that, but I guess in America in recent years, it's just really not so surprising anymore, is it?
Well, I think you probably got more chance of winning the $200 million lottery than you would have of that actually taking place.
Yeah, in any unrigged system, yes. It would be very unusual for something like that to occur. It would be like, it's just very against the odds. But we have a situation in America where we really only have one choice, and that's why I'm running for president, even though if you want to say it, it's a very difficult uphill climb. But I'm very encouraged by the things that are occurring and by the support that we're getting, even though it's not from the major media. There's a lot of subterranean support, Dr. Stan, and I'm very, very happy about that.
All right, you hang on. We'll be right back here in a moment with Michael Perutka. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Michael Perutka, and he is a lawyer. He practices in the Annapolis, Maryland area, and he is, of course, running for the Constitution Party's nomination, and he will be on the ballot in probably the majority of the states across America. The Constitution Party's been around for many years. It used to be the U.S. Taxpayers Party in California. It's the American Independent Party. But it is never mentioned by the controlled media because, of course, they don't want you really to realize that there are any other alternatives other than Socialist Party A and Socialist Party B. Now, Michael, as you see what's happening with, of course, this massive spending that's going on today, what's the implication as far as the country is concerned? In other words, when you're running deficits of $500 trillion, what's that going to mean for the future of America and for our children?
Well, we're really spending our children's inheritance, and actually, that's not quite true because we've already spent our children's inheritance. Our government is now spending our grandchildren and our great grandchildren's inheritance. These are the people that have brought you, $7 trillion worth of debt, and they really can't be trusted to steward the economy any further. We have, you asked earlier, understand why I would run for president. We really do need a president. America really deserves to have a constitutional choice. We have a supreme law of the land, the United States Constitution. All the candidates that you heard in the Democratic debates, the two major candidates now, they when they give a talk and when they address the nation in one way or another, they're telling you all the reasons that you can't vote for them in good conscience, because they're telling you that they will break their oath of office. They have no fidelity to the rule of law, the supreme law of the land, the United States Constitution. The Constitution, of course, sets out in Article 1, Section 8, those 17 or 18, depending how you count them, things that the federal government has the authority to tax and spend for. And all the programs that they talk about are unconstitutional programs. It's unconstitutional spending. And it's way, way out of control. We talked about the fact that the Republicans aren't really any different than the Democrats in this regard. Even Clinton, during his administration, the federal government only grew by about 3.5%. That's bad enough, especially after he had declared the era of big government to be over, right? It grew by 3.5%. Under Bush, it's grown by 5.6% by some estimates. So it's on the order of magnitude of almost twice what Clinton did. Other programs, for example, such as, you know, it's funny, I use the word program. Joseph Sobern wrote an article, I think it was Sobern.
Hold that thought just a moment. All right, our guest is Michael Perutka, candidate for the presidency and the Constitution Party, and you were just saying that Joseph Sobern had written an article. What was that about?
I was just saying parenthetically that Sobern once wrote that if they call it a program, it's probably unconstitutional. So you can just take for granted things that are called programs are pretty well unconstitutional. And many people don't really understand the magnitude of this problem. Some do, many do, but many do not even begin to comprehend that, you know, I've heard different percents, up to 90% actually of what the federal government spends is not constitutional. It's not lawful. It's not authorized. So we could actually do away with the federal income tax. We could survive very nicely if we cut our programs back to constitutional spending, and we could do away with the federal income tax. I've heard it once said that mostly you hear people arguing between P and Q. When you hear the Democrats arguing against the Republicans, you're really hearing P arguing with Q, and you're not seeing or hearing the rest of the debate. And we hear, I was asked on the radio yesterday about do I favor Bush's tax cut or not? Which do I side do I agree with? Well, I don't agree with either side. To talk about whether we're going to get a $300 tax cut or give it back or this or that, or that's P arguing with Q. That's not a real debate. What we really need is to cut out the unconstitutional spending and return to a government that follows the rule of law. And that's what we promised people. We would follow the rule of law. If Michael Perutka was elected president of the United States, I would abide by the United States Constitution. And that simple message has resonated with many, many, many people, and I'm very encouraged, as I was saying before, by the support that we're starting to get. I ask people to go to our website, which is perutka2004.com, and that's perutka2004.com, perutka2004.com. And I ask people to go there and look at what we're, not only what we're saying, but what others are starting to say about us. It's Dr. Stan, it's really encouraging.
Well, I'm encouraged because I think there are an awful lot of good people out across America who love the Lord, who love freedom, and want to maintain this country. So let's get into some specific issues. How do you feel about the president's No Child Left Behind educational system?
Well, it should be left behind. It really is the program. Again, there's that word program again. It should be left behind. You know, Republicans really thought they were voting for a difference when they voted for George Bush with respect to education. You know, as recently as 1996, the platform of the Republican Party called for the abolition of the Federal Department of Education because it's not, federal role in education is not in Article 1, Section 8, as we said before. So there is no federal role. There should be no Federal Department of Education. And like I say, recently that was the Republican position, but after Bush was elected, he actually on his website brags about the fact that he's spending over $50 billion dollars on the Department of Education. And that's only, by the way, a portion of the federal spending on education. It comes in through some other departments as well. He actually promised that he would end the federal meddling in education, but he hasn't done that at all. Actually, there's a great deal more meddling going on, and you know, we say you're never going to do it right if you do it unconstitutionally. If we don't follow the rules, we're going to end up with a bad result, and that's just an example of a program that shouldn't even exist at all. And it doesn't make schools safer. It doesn't make children smarter. It actually helps to dumb them down more. And you know, it's just something that we would end. We would carry out the promise of the Republican Party in 1996 and end the Federal Department of Education.
All right, fine. Now, what about this new Medicare drug bill? This, of course, was supposed to cost $400 billion over a period of 10 years, and then hardly was the ink dry on the legislation. They were talking about $550 billion over 10 years. What are your thoughts on that, and can we rely upon these estimates that they're putting out as far as the cost of these medical programs that they're coming up with?
Dr. Stan, I think people can judge for themselves the unreliability of these estimates. I mean, they don't really... It makes you wonder if they know what they're doing at all. Going back to the beginning of Medicare in 1965, I'm old enough to remember that a lot. I know you're not. You're just a youngster. but back when that started in 65, they said that they estimated that in 1990 the program was going to cost I think it was $9 billion. So it was going to cost $9 billion in 1990. But when we got to 1990, it was costing $70 billion. And that was the original Medicare program. Now, this change to the Medicare program, this prescription drug is estimated to cost $400 billion, and then just a couple of weeks later we hear, oops, oh, it's $540 billion. They don't really know what these are the people that brought you $7 trillion of debt. At least it was $7 trillion when this radio program began. Who knows what it is now? So it's just way out of control. And Medicare again is something. Here we go again. We could talk about the fact that it's a counterproductive program. It hasn't helped the healthcare delivery system in America. It's not the jurisdiction of the federal government to be involved in healthcare. It's not in Article 1, Section 8. I'm going to sound like a broken record, Dr. Stan. It's not there. It's not the jurisdiction of the federal government to be involved in it.
Well, if you're running under the Constitution Party, I expect you to keep referring back to the rule book. And that's the Constitution, which I believe is based upon biblical concepts of right and wrong. Let's get on into something I know that many people are concerned about. Today we were horrified to hear about the bombing in Madrid, 200 people dead, 1,000 injured. Apparently it was an al-Qaeda attack, at least that's what we're telling us. But how do you feel about the war in Iraq? Should we be there? Are we justified in fighting terrorism to protect our shores?
I believe that we are justified in protecting our shores. This is a very important point, Dr. Stan. You know, I think it was John Quincy Adams in 1821 and I might not get this quote exactly right, but he said, you know, we are friends of liberty everywhere, but we are guardians. We're guardians of our own liberty. It is regrettable that there might be difficulties in Iraq. I hope and pray that the Iraqi people will develop for themselves a system of justice and a republic where they can live in liberty. I don't think that it's any business of the United States to be nation building. Again, I don't find nation building in Article 1, Section 8. It's not something that we can tax and spend money for. And the war, of course, in Iraq, the war against Saddam Hussein, our sending of military forces there, was not authorized by a declaration of war by Congress, who again, here I go again, broken record, it's not authorized by the United States Constitution. The Congress could declare war against Iraq. They could do that, but they didn't, and they haven't. And so it's a violation of the president's oath to be sending troops where war has not been declared. And people say, well, by resolution, Congress gave him the authority. Here we go, sticking point again. Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution says that all legislative powers herein granted are vested in a Congress. That is to say, the power to declare a war is vested in Congress. It can't be divested. It can't be given over to the president by resolution, and he can't usurp it by means of the resolution. So again, we're not following the rules. And when you don't follow the rule of law, you get a chaotic and oftentimes a tyrannical result. So, before we leave that point, Dr. Stan, let me also just say one more thing, because I had a talk show host jump down my throat for this yesterday, but I tried to make the point that, you know, when I hear the term war on terror, I think that should raise a red flag for us here in America, because and if you read the book 1984, it should also be an Orwellian concept to you as well. Terror is not the enemy. Terror is not an enemy. Terror is a strategy or a tactic, really a tactic of an enemy. And if you fight a war on terror, I'm concerned that it's a war that really has no end, can never have an end. I think we have to be very careful about that, about accepting that terminology. And, you know, Thomas Paine said, I think in the very first sentence of his work, Common Sense, he said, a long habit of not thinking a thing to be wrong gives it a superficial appearance of being right. So a long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it a superficial appearance of being right, but it's still not right. So if we, just because we keep hearing these terms, war on terror, war on terror, that doesn't make it an accurate term. It doesn't make it right.
And, of course, I would simply add that, what you want to do, of course, is realize that you cannot have a terrorist movement unless they have a financial base, unless they have a government behind them. So who is the government behind the Al-Qaeda terrorists? Who was it who provided the terrorists that attacked the United States? Who was it who provided 15 of the 19 terrorists who attacked the World Trade Center? And, of course, it was Saudi Arabia.
Right. Saudi Arabia.
Why don't we let's talk about Saudi Arabia. Why is the Bush administration doing everything they can to protect the Saudi Arabians? And when they had the Select Committee report published, this Bush administration went through that. They took out 28 pages dealing with Saudi Arabia. In fact, I went through that report. I went through 200 pages. On 78 pages, there were deletions. There was a lot more than just 28 pages deleted. In fact, anything that really got to what was really behind the attack was deleted by the administration. Really doesn't make sense, but maybe we ought to start looking behind the scenes to see what's going on.
I hope you got the
best of that talk show host. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Michael Perugia, who's running for the Constitution Party nomination for the President of the United States. And he's been speaking all across America. I understand you, what, had 1,000 people out to hear you? Where was that?
Well, we were out in Great Falls, Montana, Dr. Stan, and we had, I think, over 1,000 people at the Great Falls Civic Arena there, and what a thrill. You know, Dr. Stan, there's only 800,000 people in Montana.
And, of course, you know, when John Kerry gets 50 people out, why, you see him on television, ABC, CBS, NBC, and CNN.
Right.
And, in fact, John Edwards didn't have that many people out to a lot of his meetings, but, boy, he sure got the play from the media.
Well,
anyway,
well,
let's get on into some of the other major issues that are facing us today. And I think one of the biggest issues we see is this loss of jobs. What are your opinion about the loss of jobs? And, of course, how will this impact upon the average citizen here in America? And why aren't there any jobs out there?
Well, Dr. Stan, I had the privilege this past Saturday of joining up and attending a program given by a group called American Cause, which, of course, Pat Buchanan helped to found. Well, he did found the group, and he was there, and I had the privilege of meeting with him, and also Congressman Tom Tancredo, who's the head of the House Immigration Caucus. And there are about 200 people in attendance, and some very, very educated and good speakers on the subject of the loss of jobs and the importation of cheap labor, the immigration problem, and they're very, very obviously connected issues. Mr. Jim Painyard of the Pennsylvania Manufacturing Association talked a little bit about what's going on in that state, in Pennsylvania, and talked about the fact that, you know, Pennsylvania used to have a million manufacturing jobs, and now it has, just in the last couple of years, it's slipped to 715,000 jobs, and they estimate they're losing 150 jobs a day. And, of course, as those jobs are lost, a manufacturing job or a plant closes down, or even a small manufacturer closes down, the diner across the street closes down, you know, and the people who make who make work boots in that region, they closed down. And so there's a huge ripple effect in the economy. And what's really at the base of this is something that they call free trade. And this idea of free trade is something that's almost become an idol among the powerful in America and among the elites, that this free trade is something that we have to have. Well, free trade doesn't, first of all, it's not free. It hurts America, and it has been it has resulted that NAFTA, et cetera, and what they want to do with the free trade agreement of the Americas, these are things that that will lose American jobs, because American manufacturers will put those jobs overseas where they can do it a great deal cheaper. And you know, this is a dangerous thing in America for many, many reasons. First of all, it loses us jobs. It also loses our manufacturing capabilities. This is a very serious issue that many people are now becoming more and more convinced that the Bush administration really does not care about. It doesn't care if you judge that by what they are trying to do to fix the problem. The Council of Economic Advisors, the chief of the Council of Economic Advisors, actually made the case recently, and I'm sure you're familiar with this in the news, that the loss of American jobs is actually a good thing for the economy. Now that, you know, that...
Hold that thought for just a moment, Mike. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, our guest Michael Perutia, and of course we're talking about the loss of jobs here in the American economy. And of course Michael was saying that the head of the Council of Economic Advisors to President George Bush had recently praised the idea of outsourcing our jobs, pointing out that if we could get the work, say, on computers done more cheaply over in India, why that was great for America, because the products then could be sold for far less, so we wouldn't be paying so much for our computers over here. Of course, there were some people who pointed out, well, that's all well and good, but what about the people who don't have any jobs over here? They're not going to be able to buy those computers or much of anything else. What was the response as far as that remarks by the head of George Bush's head of his Council of Economic Advisors?
Well, it really did raise a firestorm among many conservatives who have been heretofore supporting the Bush presidency. And that is something that I think is going to many people who are very committed to being the Republican Party and to supporting the Republican Party, I think this immigration issue, by the way, we've talked about jobs, we haven't really talked too much about immigration yet, but the combination of these issues is more than any other thing in the last couple of months, Dr. Stan, is moving people of the Constitution Party. People are waking up to the fact that there really isn't a dime's worth of difference between the Democrats and the Republicans on this. As a matter of fact, these policies where our borders are, for all intents and purposes, open borders, and this policy that immigration quote unquote reform that Bush has proposed to take 8 to 14 million workers who have broken into our country, 8 to 14 million people have broken, and all of a sudden just call them legal. As Pat Buchanan said, it's a massive reward for law breaking. It's a concession that he's just not going to uphold his oath of office to execute the laws of the land. So we've got a situation that is some of the predictions for the economy are extremely dire. One of the dangerous things, Dr. Stan, is that America losing its manufacturing base will not be able to fight the next war. I mean, we will not be able to do the things that we need to do to make the things that we need to make to defend our country, to defend our shores. And this is a thing that's hard for Americans to hear and hard to think about, but folks, it's not an accident. It's not an accident that this is occurring. The pattern of behavior is becoming more and more and more transparent, that it's on purpose that our own leaders are reducing our ability to defend ourselves. This is not something that's easy to say or to hear, but it needs to be faced by Americans. And we better wake up and smell the coffee.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and I'm very, very concerned. In the month of December, why there were about 1,000 new jobs created. In January, maybe 22,000 new jobs. This last month, in February, they said 21,000 jobs. I mean, we need 150,000 jobs just to be able to provide jobs for the people coming into the workforce, much less those who've already lost their jobs. What impact is this having on unemployment? Now, the government says our unemployment is low, but is that really true?
Well, Dr. Stan, I don't know exactly the figures that you quoted, but a lot of times when you hear some of these figures quoted about the quote-unquote creation of jobs, they're talking about government jobs.
Yes.
I mean, think about it a minute. You have to have 8 or 10 jobs out there to support a government job, and a government job really isn't a job. It's really a drain on a job. It's overhead. It doesn't take. You don't have to be a graduate of accounting school to kind of figure that out. I don't. You know, I'm not trying to sound like sound real coy or smart here. It's just so simple to see. If you call a government job the creation of a job, I mean, that's just nonsense.
I agree with you totally, and this is one of the big things that's happening. The only segments seem to be growing are certainly the defense system, the housing, and then the government, and they seem to be doing everything. They're frantically trying to get jobs going, because I think that the Bush administration realized that this is their Achilles heel, and if they don't get jobs for a lot of these people who are out of work by November, why, we may have another president in the White House.
That's what we're trying to represent, Dr. Stan. America does need a real choice, and we stand ready to be that choice. I ask people to go to Perutka2004.com, Perutka. Somebody asked me the other day, is your name going to help you or hurt you in this thing? So I don't know, but I've been spelling it a lot. It's Perutka2004.com, and please go to our website and look at what we're talking about. Look what others are now starting to say about us. We're starting to pick up steam, and you know, Dr. Stan, that it's not going to be easy to get major media to give us attention. We're going to have to do it, and to rely on people to do it by word of mouth and by spreading the website.
We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Michael Perutka, and of course we're talking about what's going on as far as the economy is concerned, and the loss of jobs, and then of course I think maybe the next major point we should hit is this massive immigration, illegal immigration, and the president's position that the only solution to the fact we have between 8 and perhaps 14 million people who are here illegally is to make them all legal. Now, what impact would that have on our society? Because they're guaranteeing that this will never happen again, but that's what they say in 84 or 83, and that's what they said in 86, and
right,
they're saying it again.
Dr. Stan, let me recommend, there's a couple of things that I'm reading just to give myself a depth and breadth of this issue, and I'm reading something right now that was given to me by written by a man named Louis T. March, M-A-R-C-H, called Immigration and the End of Self-Government. And it's a fascinating little book that actually makes the connection between this massive immigration and the inability for us to rule ourselves as a free people, to be self-governed anymore. It's a very, very interesting work. Mr. Roy Beck also has published a book called Recharting America's Future, which deals with a lot of kind of the what I'm going to call the false arguments why people that people use to support massive immigration, the arguments like we need diversity, or arguments that we need to be compassionate to the rest of the world, and these things, and he very effectively deals with these arguments. It's called Recharting America's Future, and the author is Mr. Roy Beck. His group, by the way, is called Numbers USA, and I have learned a lot from his website, etc. So I think it's numbersusa.com, and he makes some very, very we need to be equipped with the arguments against, with the true arguments against the false arguments. So I recommend people make themselves smarter about these issues. The immigration again is just a capitulation. This immigration reform that Bush proposes is really a capitulation to the law breaking. It's really a method of saying it's so bad we can't do anything about it. And it's just a shame. We need a president who's committed to actually doing something about it. You know, Dr. Stan, back during the 30s, 40s, 50s, we had average immigration of about 178,000 immigrants a year that was legal immigration.
Wait, hold that thought for just a moment when we bring our stations right back on.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Michael Perutka. Yeah, and if you're out there, why you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, if you have something you'd like to ask Michael. But he was simply saying that, you know, in the past we would have maybe 150 or 1,000 people coming into the country a year. Why don't you pick up that thought?
Yes, during what Mr. Beck, again, I was quoting Mr. Roy Beck, what he calls the golden age of immigration, back when immigrants were able to assimilate into the culture and assimilate into the economy, we were having rates of about 178,000. I think that's the average number a year. But starting in the early 60s and then escalating since then, we started with a 500,000 from about 1960 to 1990, and now from 1990 on, we've got about 1 million legal immigrants a year and about 1 million illegal immigrants a year. And when you chart out, which he does in a very effective way, when you chart out the effect of this, it's actually a decimation of our culture, of our economy, of our environment. It's not like we're being compassionate to the rest of the world. It's not helping the rest of the world, and it's not helping the United States. And he makes you some very effective arguments to that effect. So these are things that are now coming home to roost, because Americans are now losing their jobs and losing their standard of living, and they're getting hit in the pocketbook, and they're starting to wake up. But this problem has been set in motion years ago, and we have to act quickly and decisively to. We need to go back to the golden age of immigration. We need to limit immigration back to that benchmark of 178,000, 200,000 in that vicinity a year, so we will be able to assimilate people into the culture, into the environment, and protect and expand our American culture and an American understanding of law and government and liberty, which, of course, we're losing when we lose the culture war.
Amen to that. Well, let's go to Roger, who's calling from Allentown, Pennsylvania. Roger, you have a question or comment?
Yes, thanks, gentlemen. Well, first, I want to just reinforce what you said before the break, because more often your name sounds like with an F as in Frank and not the proper P as in Peter, Perutka.
That's why, of course, I think that Michael spells that, P-E-R-O-U-T-K-A. Go ahead.
Yeah, and before my hardball question to you, Michael, I just want to encourage everybody to, like, I'd pigeonhole my local congressman on the local talk radio here, and that is, congressman, we can all agree that the last several presidential debates were totally dull and boring, and also it was all the Republican could do to out-socialism the Democrats.
Okay, did you have a question?
You're right. Well, I agree with you there.
Well, did you have a question, though?
Well, if I could quickly finish that up. And then, so, congressman, will you sponsor Ron Paul's bill to release the hammerlock control of the Presidential Debate Commission, because I'm willing to suffer with the ego-wackism of Ralph Nader for the sake of hearing a Constitution Party candidate, or do you think that the Republican candidate wouldn't be able to compete in that environment?
What'd he say?
Well, I'll have to look into that, you know.
Okay, okay.
But now my question, Michael, the Constitution Party being the best of all possible parties short of the Second Coming, could you tell us what endorsements you might have from notables such as Howard Phillips et al., And what other competition do you have for the Constitution Party candidacy? God
okay.
bless.
Thanks very much, Roger. Okay.
Roger, thank you very much. Yes, as a matter of fact, you, Mr. Howard Phillips has really been like a mentor to me, if you will. He has encouraged me along the way, and it was really his encouragement for me to run for president. And so I certainly have had Mr. Howard Phillips' endorsement. I have gotten great encouragement from many other quarters. There have been groups that have called. For example, I just got a call the other day from Dr. J. Michael Hill from what's called the League of the South, and he said, you know, we agree with your platform, and what can we do to help you? And they have 170 chapters across the South. So there are things like that, people like that who are calling. If you go to the website, and I'm sure, Roger, you've probably checked it out, you'll start to see what others are saying and other people who are endorsing us. I was very, very flattered to get an endorsement from Doug Phillips, who is a homeschool leader. He runs Vision Forum across the country, and others who are seeing that there is really, we don't have to choose the lesser of two evils anymore. You really can vote for a constitutional choice. So thank you for that question. Thank you for your support.
All right, let's go to Ray, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Ray, do you have a question?
Yeah, I just want to ask one question. I'd like to know if the gentleman has any comment on Kerry's wife, Teresa Firestein Hines Kerry, and what's going to happen when she's unmuzzled and starts talking.
I'm sorry.
I really don't have. I'm familiar, as you probably are, with her background. I know she's not. I don't think she's a Native American. I think she grew up in South America, I believe. And,
No. Before I get off the line, she was one of the apartheid families in Mozambique, Africa. They were ruling over the blacks there. She's a lot of strange ideas, and when she's unmuzzled, I think Kerry's finished. But she's from Mozambique. Her father was a doctor in the apartheid regime.
In Mozambique?
Yeah. Yes, yeah, I think, is she originally from Portugal or something?
Well, there's some Portuguese in her ancestry. One of her names is Ferrara,
okay.
but her father's name was Firestein.
Well, yeah. We'll just have to wait until she is unmuzzled, or maybe they'll just keep her muzzled anyway. Thanks so much,
well,
Ray.
I know that she does, yes.
All right.
I'm not sure it's appropriate to comment on Kerry's wife, except that I know she was an heiress, and she's had some political connections in the past. So I think it's probably relevant.
All right, fine. I would not, however, call the regime in Mozambique apartheid. Actually, in the Portuguese colonies, they did not have any racial discrimination as such. Certainly, there were many whites there. And it was a very, very prosperous country until, of course, the revolution came. And as with so many countries, once the revolution comes, there's all sorts of problems that develop. However, certainly in Angola and in Mozambique, which were the two Portuguese colonies in Africa, I know from first-hand experience, because I lived in Portugal for a time, that there was no racial discrimination or official racial discrimination comparable to the apartheid regime in neighboring South Africa. So, be that as it may, we have a couple of other callers I think we'll have on the line here very, very shortly, but some of the other issues that I think are really going to be major issues. And one of them, of course, would be your position on the Second Amendment. Certainly the President has said that if they put up forward this bill that is going to renew the ban on automatic or they call them assault weapons. They're not assault weapons. They're simply semi-automatic weapons. But the President has said that he will sign that over the objection of the NRA and gun owners and other pro-gun groups. How do you feel about the Second Amendment and the right of the people to keep and bear arms?
Well, I agree with George Washington, who said that the right to bear arms is the liberty teeth of a free society. I understand what the word shall not be infringed means. As a matter of fact, Dr. Stan, probably the Second Amendment is really the amendment that's written with the widest scope and the broadest breadth. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law respecting established religion, but the Second Amendment says that the right of the people shall not be infringed from anywhere. So it's an affirmative responsibility of the federal government to make sure that that the right should, cannot be infringed from any quarter. All the gun control laws that we've had, of course, the assault weapons ban is something from a federal government point of view that I, of course, would not sign. You're very correct that these things aren't assault weapons at all. This is another deconstruction of definitions, and the assault weapons ban is set to sunset here, and it should sunset. It should never have been enacted, and it's a violation of the Second Amendment, and therefore it's really not law at all. It's void. It's been enforced. People have lost their liberty because of it, but it's really not law at all, because the supreme law of the land is the United States Constitution.
All right, fine. We've got Anthony calling from Chicago. Hi, Anthony. How are you doing tonight?
Hi, Dr. Stan. How are you?
Doing fine.
Well, you know, it's pretty funny that you guys mentioned, of course, the Second Amendment. That totally detracts from my question, but it's just funny to note that, of course, handguns and other semi-automatic weapons are banned in the city limits where I live. Of course, it's freely available outside of the city limits. And that's an interesting issue. But this question relates directly to the topic at hand, the spread of globalization that you guys talked about earlier. And my question is really, why is it that it's okay to bring the concept of the democratic popular vote to places like the Middle East and the Balkans and the Third World, but we keep our own political choices limited to an elite electoral college, barring the realistic chances of parties like the Constitutional Party, the Constitution Party, the Green Party, and so forth. We need more choices. That's one thing.
All right, let's just one question at a time. Let's give that to Mr. Michael Perutka, and then, of course, we'll give you another question if you'd like.
Okay, thank you.
Too many questions sometimes get a little distracted. So how would you respond to what Anthony's saying?
Yeah, Anthony, our guests aren't smart enough to hold two questions in their mind at one time. I'm sorry.
No, it's really the talk show host isn't smart enough, because she can't remember what the three or four questions were. So I'd like to take one at a time.
That's right. I appreciate that. I think the first question had to do with the limiting of our choices. It is unusual to think that we promote democracy. Of course, they keep calling it democracy. We don't have a democracy here. We have a representative republic, a constitutional republic, which recognizes a higher moral law. What they're trying to do over there in Iraq is something that probably will never work, because it's fundamentally flawed. They're trying to nation build by enforcing a democracy on people, when they say democracy, I don't know exactly what they do mean. But it's you can't impose this on a people. The self-government that you're looking for here, that would be the model, really comes from a people that is self-governed. It comes from a culture that is capable of that, and a culture that's capable of that is a culture that's based on an acknowledgement of a creator God from whom all rights come. That's how we're founded in the United States of America. And that rights come from God, and that the purpose of government is to protect and defend those rights. So if you don't have the purpose right, you're not going to have a good result. So I agree with you. It's strange.
Okay, it's interesting that over, of course, in Iraq, why they want to acknowledge that God, but their God is Allah, and they want to impose Sharia law, which takes away the rights of women, puts them into an inferior position, lops off hands and feet, if you're caught stealing, and your head if you're caught adultery, and that's not necessarily the sort of God that we would want to have directing our society. So anyway, let's go back to Anthony. Anthony, do you have another question?
Well, my other question was, of course, a multi-part attached to the other one, but of course it was, in the case of the 2000 presidential election, why is it that it was Antonin Scalia's choice, and how did they get by the average American?
You're talking about, of course, the fact that he was the swing vote, or what?
Oh, yeah, the Supreme Court in general basically selected our current president. That's a matter of debate, I know, but, something has to be done, and people have to realize that politicians work for us, and not for special interest and
right.
Corporate entities. And this is still, we're still letting this go, and people still are not getting the word out. I mean, not to the mainstream American anyway.
All right, fine. How would you respond to what Anthony is saying? And, of course, I think he's really concerned about the election of 2000, where the Florida Supreme Court, which was, of course, a political group of political appointees, came up with one conclusion, and then they took it to the Supreme Court, and they came up with the other conclusion. And since they were the highest court, that sure. then gave George Bush the election. And how would you respond to that?
Well,
that
well,
is a sticky issue.
It is. And let me. One of the impressions I have of the 2000 election that keeps sticking in my mind, Anthony, maybe you remember when they showed that map, that the map that showed the counties that had voted for Bush and the counties that had voted for Gore. And I think I remember that it was the red counties that were Bush and the blue that was for Gore. And if you stood back halfway across the room, basically, it was a red map. It was a red map with little splotches of blue up there and over there and across there and up there near the Great Lakes. There was, and I think that's where you said you're from. So we have these splotches, and if you looked at it geographically, the rural interests of the interests of America were greatly red, except the vote was 50-50. Those little splotches represented as much interest. And so I think that's actually what's good about the Electoral College, because I sensed in your statement there that the Electoral College is something that you think is part of the problem. I really think the Electoral College is a genius part of the solution, or at least it's a check on the interest of the few, and it helps the interest of the many. But
Anthony, if I could comment. Basically, one of the problems we have is that if you've got newspapers and television and radio that are all pushing one candidate, that's the way the majority of people are going to go. This is what happens in your major metropolitan areas, and that's, of course, where Al Gore did so well. It was in the hinterlands that George Bush did so well. Now, I'm not convinced there's a great deal of difference between the two of them. I'm not sure we would not be perhaps somewhat better with Al Gore. I do not think we would have a Republican opposition. But be that as it may, the Electoral College was established by our founding fathers to prevent a true democracy. The last thing they wanted here was a one-man, one-vote situation. They wanted to create a Republican form of government and take away from the people the right to vote themselves into tyranny, which they have down through history, whether it was Greece or Rome or so many times before. So I think that our form of government, imperfect as it is the greatest form that exists. We just need to get the people involved and get responsible people into our courts. Anything else, Anthony?
Well, I would tend to agree with you to a degree. Of course, again, it goes back to the original question as to, you know, how can we push a form of government that we and ourselves don't necessarily endorse?
Well,
especially the gentleman from the Constitutional Party, the candidate, and I apologize for not remembering his name.
Michael Perutka.
But, you know, one of the other things, too, that I'd have to mention in contrast to what you said about that was that, you know, you've got these third world countries.
Go ahead.
Oh, in the third world countries and in the Middle East, you've got lots of different ethnic groups that have no commonalities. They have no unifying voice, but of course now we force them all to actually see that distinct difference. Ethnically.
Hang on. We're going to ask Michael that question.
Okay, thank you.
Well, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, our guest is Michael Perutka, who is the Constitution Party's presidential candidate, or hopefully he will be. And Anthony makes a very good point. And look at Iraq. I mean, you've got your Shia Muslims, you've got your Sunni Muslims, you've got your Kurds, and none of them like one another. So we're trying to force them all to get together into this big, one happy democracy. And he thinks that there's certain inconsistency in this. How are you going to get people who can't stand one another, who hate one another, to work together?
Well, and I agree. I think it is a fallacy, and I think what you're hinting at is that it's hypocritical, and I'm going to agree with you. And I think it's an excellent point that the ability to self-govern arises out of a culture that is self-governing. it starts with a personal virtue that's inculcated in the people by their religious beliefs, and that gives a group the capacity to self-govern. And we were so blessed in America to have a tradition and a set of circumstances so that could be established and in fact flourish. But we've moved away from that now. We don't have that anymore. And what we're trying to we don't as a culture we've moved away from a biblical worldview and an American view of the purpose of government, and we are very imperfect, and now we're trying to establish something over there, and it's not our business to do that, I don't believe, Anthony. I don't think, and again, as I said earlier, nation building isn't anywhere in Article 1, Section 8.
Okay, thanks very much for calling, Anthony.
I appreciate it, Dr. Smith. Just one last thing I'd say, and then I'll definitely go, which is that it's unfortunate that nation building isn't necessary. It's the smokescreen for the rampant, and actually, dare I say, fascist capitalism that is the free-flowing pot over in Iraq right now. And that's what's frightening. And I'd say thank you, and I wish you luck in the upcoming election.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, fine. And so,
Dr. Stan, just to add to that point, one more point, if I could, I have a I read something just the other day where the Secretary of Health and Human Services is advocating $900 million so that we can improve the health care in Iraq. So we're now not only is it health care in Article 1, Section 8 for the federal government to do in America, now we're doing it, now we're spending America's money to do it in Iraq. We're way through the looking glass here.
We certainly are. Well, Michael, thank you so much for being with us, and the best of luck to you in the coming weeks and months as we begin moving towards the November election. And, of course, I appreciate your message. I hope our listeners do as well.
Well, I thank your listeners, Dr. Stan, and I thank you for all your faithful and good work out in his field. Thank you so much, sir.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening has been Michael Perutka. And, of course, you can just go to his website and look at it. I think it's perutka.com, probably, perutka.com or perutka.org, P-E-R-O-U-T-K-A. But at this point, of course, we need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're dependent upon those of you who believe, as I do, that we stand to lose this country, that we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological battlefield. And if you agree with us, we hope that many of you will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Going along with what Michael had said, I would simply remind you of those words of William Penn, who said that those who will not be ruled by God will be ruled by tyrants. America was established as a free nation because people were ruled by God individually. And in fact, it was John Adams who said, "Our form of government was made for a moral and religious people. It would not work for any other. You could not have a government that was limited unless you had moral people." And that is, of course, why there's been a specific and intentional attack on the Judeo-Christian concepts here in America. That's why there's been an effort to take God and prayer out of our schools, because if we could remove any knowledge of God from our young people, you would have chaos, and that's exactly the direction we're heading. So if you'd like to become part of our team, as you know, we're on the air 5 hours every day. You can listen to our programs at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And you can either link to or listen to our programs. Then you can listen to our archives. You can pull down our newsletters. You can notice all the things that we do carry that do help us be able to maintain our position on the air. We're heard about 60 outlets every week, and it's an expensive proposition. If you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family of supporters, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV. More. If you'd like, of course, to get a free copy of our February newsletter, and that tells you what happened on September the 11th, what was Dick Cheney doing that morning in the Presidential Emergency Operating Center, the basement of the White House? Well, Norman Mineta testified to what happened that morning, May 23rd last year, before the 9/11 Commission, and amazingly enough, not a word of that got into the controlled media. And Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly and Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw are yet to tell us what Norman Mineta said about what happened that morning as they monitored the plane coming in to hit the Pentagon. So if you'd like a copy of the newsletter, give us a call. That's the February newsletter you'll want. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you want, of course, the letter that deals with Alexander the Great and his connection to the mystery religions, which are really the basis of what's going on today, that is the January newsletter. And, of course, you can pull down all of our newsletters going back to the mid-1990s at www.radioliberty.com. We hope that you'll tell others about our radio programs. We hope that you'll tell them about our website. We hope that you'll encourage them to listen either the shortwave or to the Internet or to the local stations in your area. And so we want to mention the video, Brotherhood of Darkness, the video, Diapraxin, the church, which covers what's happening as far as the church growth movement, which is sweeping America. But, of course, what is the real agenda behind that? The video, Megiddo, the March to Armageddon, going into the fact we are actually in World War III. The Best Enemies Money Could Buy, my interview with Professor Sutton before he died, but this is an interview I did back in 1980. We went into who funded the North Vietnamese during the Vietnam War, who funded the communists, who funded the Nazis. Well, you'll certainly want to see our video, The Best Enemy Money's Goodbye. And there's a book, of course, that goes along with it. Remember our number, it's 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, and we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, because we're on the front lines of this battle. And so until tomorrow evening, when we'll be with you once again, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we always welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But, of course, we are hoping this evening to have a special guest on talking about music and about the impact of music on the individual, but barring that, why, it's going to be just you and me, and I think we'll just get started with the topic, and of course we'll be glad to open up the lines for calls if you want to give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. You go ahead. But I was thinking earlier this evening about, of course, what happened in Madrid and the horrible thing that here 200 people dead and 1,000 injured, and who was really responsible for this? Well, everything is pointing to the fact that Al-Qaeda was, but who then created Al-Qaeda? Because Al-Qaeda did not exist 25 years ago. Al-Qaeda is a relatively new appearance. You'd never heard of this. You might have heard of it in the mid-1990s, but that was less than a decade ago. But you go back to 1980, nobody had ever heard of Al-Qaeda. In fact, there really was no radical Islamic movement anywhere in the world. Oh, yes, there was this idea among the Wahhabi leaders in Saudi Arabia and within the members of the Muslim Brotherhood that was established in Egypt in 1928, but there was no radical Islamic movement that threatened the West. There was no threat of a clash of civilizations. There was no mention of radical Islam moving to take over the world. At one time, of course, there had been this radical Islamic movement, and there had been a war between Christianity and the Muslims for many, many hundreds of years. But the Muslims were driven out of Spain in 1492, and because of that, Queen Isabella commissioned Christopher Columbus to seek for the New World. And then, of course, in 1683 at the Battle of Vienna, why the Muslims were turned back, and, of course, the Christians failed in that battle, why we would all be speaking Arabic at the present time. But anyway, of course, after the First World War, and certainly after the Second World War, the radical Islamic movement that wanted to conquer the world had pretty well been subsided, and there was no serious threat from the Islamic movement. So where did it come from? Well, of course, you really can't just take an isolated question like that, and without perhaps going back and putting things into a historical perspective. So let me take you back to the period immediately following the Second World War. And there was, of course, America had fought and fought valiantly along with its allies, England and France, to defeat the Axis powers, Germany and Italy and Japan, and create this idea of a democratic world, a world where men could be free. And they talked about the four freedoms and restoring and establishing democracy throughout the world. Of course, there again is that word democracy. They should really have been talking about establishing republics throughout the world, because democracies, as James Madison had said in the 10th of the Federalist Papers, are rare spectacles of turbulence and contention, are ever incompatible with personal liberty or the rights of private property, and are usually as short in their lives as they are violent in their deaths. America was not a democracy, it was a republic. So why do we want to establish democracies throughout the world? Well, of course, in the period immediately following the Second World War, the American public had been dumbed down, so most people didn't even understand the difference between a republic and a democracy. And this is Dr. Stan, and of course we're talking about the period immediately following the Second World War, and so of course the Russians had been allowed to occupy Eastern Europe. The Allies occupied the western part of Europe. And what was the most amazing thing was that the communists were our sworn enemies, and yet somehow why we were their allies. The war had started because Poland had been invaded from the west by Adolf Hitler and from the east by Joseph Stalin. And yet, of course, England and France declared war only on Adolf Hitler. They didn't declare war on Joseph Stalin, who was equally responsible for starting the Second World War. But people don't understand that everything is manipulated. Nothing is as it actually appears to be. And so it was during the Second World War that America gave massive amounts of aid, financial aid and economic aid to Russia. We not only did that, but we gave them the plans for the Manhattan Project and the atomic bomb. And if you haven't read that wonderful book entitled From Major Jordan's Diary, you should try to find a copy of it and read it. And then, of course, after the Second World War, when the Russians had moved into Eastern Europe, and they literally raped every woman there. Of course, they never mentioned that here in America, because that would have some people might have wondered why we were backing this country that was so brutal that they allowed a mass rape. I've talked to some of the women who were there and read books about it. Horrible, horrible story. The men were rounded up, was taken off to Siberia, where many of them died, in the, either working in the mines or working in the factories there. And, of course, all of the factories were taken out of Eastern Europe and sent off to Russia. And then, according to Major Jordan, from Major Jordan's diary, why the American government gave the Russians the plates for our occupation currency, so that we could actually, the Russians then could print our occupation currency, and we would redeem it, so that we would, be financing the Russian occupation and rape of Eastern Europe. It really didn't make sense. There was a book that was called "I Saw Poland Betrayed," and the book was written by Arthur Bliss Lane, who was the American ambassador to Poland. And what was so amazing was that he pointed out that the American State Department was primarily responsible for bringing communism to Poland. And then, of course, in the years that followed, it was the American State Department that was responsible for bringing communism to China. And those of you who are unacquainted with the reports that came out of our congressional investigating committees at that time, specifically the McCarran Committee report. Well, Dr. Stan back here, specifically the McCarran Committee report. If you read the McCarran Committee report, you will find out that the American State Department put an arms embargo on General Chiang Kai-shek, who headed the Nationalist Army, so that he couldn't buy weapons anywhere in the world. It wasn't that the Chinese communists won the war. There wasn't any war. Chiang Kai-shek had very little to fight with. He was prevented from buying weapons anywhere in the world. The weapons he had already bought and paid for were on Okinawa and other Pacific islands. They didn't have access to. The American State Department, pardon me, the American Congress appropriated $125 million, probably the equivalent to $10 billion today, of weapons for the Nationalist Army. And the State Department just refused to send them. They kept the ships in harbor in San Francisco and Los Angeles fully loaded with weapons that the Nationalist Army needed to defend itself against the Chinese communist onslaught, and wouldn't let the ships sail. And it was a year and a half to 2 years before those ships finally arrived in China. And when they arrived in China, and they opened up the cases of guns, the guns didn't have any bolts in them or were useless. We brought communism to China. We did it intentionally. We did it purposely. The investigative committees of Congress came to that conclusion. And as a result of that, of course, there were several investigations. One of them was the Rees Committee investigation of the great tax-exempt foundations, because the Rockefeller and Ford and Carnegie foundations had actually financed the various subversive organizations in the United States that had influenced the American people to believe that Chairman Mao was the George Washington of China. He was the Abraham Lincoln of China. He was supposedly this most wonderful individual who brought freedom to China. He was simply an agrarian reformer. He wasn't a real communist. Oh, Chairman Mao wasn't a communist at all. He was an agrarian reformer. And the lies were told, and the American people believed it, just as today the lies are told and the American people believe it. But when Congress investigated to find out who would finance it, it was the Rockefeller and Ford and of course, the Carnegie institutions. So, there's nothing there. So, basically, we have, we finally got our guest on the line here. Hello, is this Mr. Talbot?
Yes.
Okay, fine. I'm so glad to have you with us.
Well, thanks. It's a privilege.
All right, fine. Well, we've been just sort of filling in here till we got you. Tell us, you are actually in charge of music. You have a degree in music, and you've studied music for many years?
Well, that's a fair statement, yes. I haven't studied beyond the bachelor's level, but yes, I'm a graduate in music from Westmont College in Santa Barbara.
All right, fine. Well, of course, we've seen a lot of changes in music.
Oh, yeah.
In recent years. First of all, do you think that music has a ability to have a profound impact on people and their emotions and their response?
Oh, no doubt about it. That's a given, at least in Christian music. Well, of any kind of music.
Well, of course, my concern is some of the other music that's not necessarily Christian music, but, of course, is so common among our young people today.
Yes.
And, of course, down through the years, certainly through the centuries, do you think influence has had, that music has had an impact on civilization and altering civilizations?
Well, I don't know if I'm enough of a historian to answer that adequately, but I would say that's a fair statement. Music is used in so much of our lives. In almost any kind of a special event or milestone in daily living you can think of, music is involved, and so much more so for people involved with their religion actively.
Well, certainly we can see that within the, for instance, a motion picture, why the music, even though you're not aware of it, is setting the tone for what's really happening on the screen.
Sure.
Well,
so
now,
it can definitely evoke, you know, the old when the talkie movies first came out, and before that, everything was dependent upon the pianist beating away on an old upright to set the mood for the whodunit. Shoot 'em up movies and all that, and all through our culture, music has been a huge part of the movie industry.
Well, now, of course, there's some people who say that there's no such thing as Christian music. There's only Christian lyrics, that all music is made by God, so all music is good. Would you agree or disagree with that statement?
That all music is good?
Yes. In fact, there's a very prominent a minister who's made this statement, that all music is good, so don't you criticize the music that we're using in our church.
You know, I would have a struggle with that, and I'd have to hear what he was specifically referring to in his own church. But there's bad music. That's what we have critics for. I think there's terrible music and things that are masquerading in the form of perhaps sincere artistic expression still can, to any kind of an educated ear, can come across as bad music. So I think his statement is a little overblown.
All right.
And I don't know who you're talking about, but I would love to challenge somebody like that head on.
Well, you probably would be in a better position to challenge him than I would. we will not, of course, be mentioning any specific names, but I would just comment his most recent book just sold 10 million copies.
Oh, boy.
But anyway, of course, then, let's talk a little bit about bad music. Do you think that some of the music that, for instance, we have played by our young people in these various dances that they have, the rave dances, and do you think that some of this has a deleterious effect on the hearts and souls of our young people?
Well, that's probably a fair statement. I'm not a real student of contemporary secular music because my whole life is spent in the religious realm. Young people are influenced by music, and I think there's contemporary secular music that is not very edifying in any stretch of the imagination. There's music that's sensuous and improperly sensuous. You know, music can be used for so many different purposes, and today it seems like contemporary music is just trying to stretch the borders of appropriate taste, and to keep the young people interested, it seems like we have to go further and further afield. And it used to be just suggestive lyrics. Now it's just outright ribald lyrics, and what some people would even call pornographic is getting such intense airplay with the younger generation. So it is disturbing, and I think it is a tremendous factor in our culture.
Well, is there any of this spreading into the Christian music? Is Christian music changing from what it was 40 or 50 years ago when I was a young man? Has Christian music changed? And if it has changed, are the changes for the better?
Oh, well, obviously Christian music has changed, yeah. I don't know where we are age-wise, but I'm 61. And when I was in high school and leading a high school youth group and playing the piano for services at church, everything was pretty much the same and predictable, and there wasn't a huge amount of music coming out. But when we hit the 60s and the Jesus People movement got going, and then the Maranatha music sprung up from the ministry of Chuck Smith and whatnot, just this huge outflowing of creative work in the Christian area, This dramatically changed the way churches worship, and so there's no question about that. There's been fantastic changes since the 60s, and I'm not saying what we had in the 60s and 70s was the only thing to emulate, and I don't want to hold on to the old days unnecessarily. I guess my biggest concern is that in the process of going so contemporary in the name of being seeker-sensitive that we have abandoned our heritage in music in so many areas, and to have young people not even recognize some of the classics of Christian music heritage is really a sadness to me. So we, at Mount Hermon, where I work, we try to do something about that, but the worship wars are the biggest thing to come along in church history. When I was in my young adulthood and active on church boards and whatnot, the big arguments were about the colors of the hymnals and colors of the choir robes and other things like that, and that's about as difficult of arguments as we got. But now it's what has been tagged the worship wars, and people leave churches over the issue of music. So it has had a tremendous impact on the life of the church. There's no question about that.
Well, when you speak of worship wars, are you talking about simply people don't like the music at all, or what are you speaking of specifically?
Well, yeah, you know, this is an overgeneralization because I see exceptions to this all the time, but generally the older generation says we have been abandoned in worship, and that the move to all contemporary and forgetting of our heritage leaves us out in the cold. And I hear all the time, I mean, almost every week, because I'm up front with music, both at Mount Hermon and at my local church, I hear continuously that people feel left out in the process, and many, many people say, well, we don't come for the worship part of the church. We come in late just to hear the sermon because we really like the preacher. So there's a mass boycotting of worship music in many churches, and it's not maybe the word mass boycotting is a little exaggerated, but I hear this all the time. Well, we just don't go to the early part. We come to church late on purpose because we can't stand what's going on in church musically, and that's a real sadness.
Well, I've heard this from some of my very best friends. In fact, we've left two churches because we couldn't stand the music.
Right.
And we felt that it didn't honor God. And this is the thing that disturbs me. Well, you mentioned the Maranatha music that came out in the 60s. And I'm not acquainted with that phrase. Would you like perhaps to tell us what that was?
Well, I'm thinking of the company that's called Maranatha Music, which is, to their credit, they have published some hymnals with standard hymns in it, and the combination of styles of music, so they haven't totally abandoned hymnody the way we thought of it in my growing up years. But the Maranatha music, with the advent of computers and all that, have made a big change, and I'd be happy to pursue that a little bit further if you need to take a break.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here, and I'm going to let you get into that a little bit more for us.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dave Talbot. We're talking about music and practice, about its impact. And so why don't you sort of pick up on that thought that that we were talking about?
Yes. Well, the Maranatha Music Company came out of a movement that was encouraged out of the Jesus movement. And what made it so pervasive in this country was modern technology. For many months, and actually into years, I was a member of a club that would receive a cassette tape a month with all of the supposedly latest music. Well, I was one of tens of thousands of music people across the country receiving these simultaneously, and so everybody would get their tape and play it and hear what was supposedly the latest new and best Christian music, and they just instantaneously were able to take over the shaping of music tastes in the country, and people just assumed that this is the way we should go. Now, not everybody went for that, but it had an amazing influence on our church music. And I'm not saying that that's all negative at all. They've given us much music that is lovable and sung regularly in church, and I enjoy, and almost anybody would enjoy. So you can't. I want to just be careful that I'm not suggesting that we castigate all contemporary music, because there's a lot of wonderful stuff. Look at things like that we just are coming to call hymns now, like Jack Hayford's Majesty. That's only 20 years old. Some people would say that's not contemporary at all anymore. You got to be within 2 years to be contemporary, but that is an example of a piece that was considered very avant-garde when it came out, but now every church sings music like that, and that was fostered so dramatically by the spread of cassette tapes, and of course then it jumped to CDs and DVDs, and so the Maranatha Music Company continues, Hosanna and Maranatha continue to spread their selections from a somewhat narrow base of reference to all that will purchase it across the country. So they've had a tremendous impact on church music. And I think in some ways worship leaders have been sold a bill of goods that way, and not everybody has gone for that. There are many churches that are still independent in their leadership of music. And I think one of the things that they have fostered is somewhat making the style of music, the king of worship. And I really reject that, and a lot of thinking people do. I think that you cannot just say we are going to have only one style of music because this is what reaches people. Our culture is way too diverse to make a statement like that and have it hold water. And I think churches that have gone that route have regretted it. And I think now the happy thing is that there is some swinging of the pendulum back to a more balanced use of music. And there are some fabulous, influential, big churches that are doing a good deal of traditional music along with the contemporary that is useful and fits a theme rather than just saying it has to all be one style. That's the danger I think we get into. And my own church is, I think, one of the last major churches in the Santa Cruz, California area that still has two types of distinct service, a contemporary and a traditional. Almost all the major churches in the area have gone to all
hold that thought.
Contemporary.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dave Talbot. Now, Dave, why don't you explain to us, is this the contemporary music, praise music, would you call it praise music? Sometimes we almost hear like a mantra, repeating these phrases over and over and over and over again. Could you describe what the contemporary music is and how it differs from traditional music?
Well, that is one characteristic of contemporary music that probably aggravates the older generation more than anything else, is what they would call a mindless repetition of phrases. You have a little bit of that in traditional hymns. You have a hymn with four or five verses, and you sing the same chorus each time you come through, so there's a little bit of repetition there that we sometimes forget that we have, but typically the traditional music does not have nearly the degree of repetition that we have in the contemporary music. The contemporary Christian music has moved much more towards feeling. It's much less objective and more subjective. It's about my feelings and how I feel about my God and my worship experience. And if you look at texts of contemporary music, you'll find the personal pronouns are there an awful lot more than in some of our great hymns of the faith. So there's been a me-centeredness, which I find disturbing occasionally. But I want to say these are exciting times, because with the huge spread of technology and the capacity to create music and MIDI systems and being able to, you know, I can play a synthesizer from my big Baldwin organ at Mount Hermon, or I can do it the other way around. You can hook up an organ to a piano, a synthesizer to a piano. You can layer music. You can create a whole orchestra with just a computer. I mean, these are things that we never even dreamed of 20 years ago. And now everybody can become a composer and an arranger with relatively little effort compared to the old way that our predecessors had to notate everything by hand. So modern technology has helped spawn a huge outpouring of creativity. I would just say this, Christian Camp, let's see, Christian CCLI, Licensing International, I can't remember the first word, but the licensing organization that allows you to put overhead projectors and PowerPoint up on the screen and not be in violation of copyright, they say that there are over 200,000 Christian songs under license with them, and so it's mind-boggling the output of creativity that is, at least in the legitimate area, a lot of people aren't doing it legitimately, but at least those that are going through the licensing system, that's an incredible amount of music, and that's all come about just in the last 15, 20 years. CCLI hasn't even been around 15 years, I don't think. So things have changed dramatically, and this can make for exciting times because it allows a person with maybe very meager resources to do some spectacular things with music. The question is, is it spectacular or is it dull and boring? And that leads me to, if you want to pursue this, the leadership of music people these days. One of my concerns is that we have abandoned somewhat the training of our musicians, and I hear all the time that somebody has been just affirmed into music leadership because he took up a guitar in high school, and he was the only one that was leading music in this little church, and pretty soon they asked him would he be the minister of music. And he has no formal training, he has no biblical training maybe, except what he gets in the church from Sunday to Sunday. And so we have affirmed into leadership positions those who have almost no traditional musical education, and that is coming back to bite the church, I think. We've done it because of economic necessity. We can't afford to go out and hire a well-educated minister of music. We maybe can't even have somebody full-time on our staff. We maybe only have one-third time or one-quarter time, or he's the youth director for the other part of his time. And so music has sometimes suffered because of that. There's a great number of musicians today who were affirmed into leadership without the educational background, and that hurts us a lot.
All right, well, we're going to have to take a break here, and of course, I really want to get into this idea that sometimes it seems that they just want to make it just as loud and as raucous as they can. They want to emphasize the beat rather than, of course, the Christian message. And I sometimes wonder, as I hear this rock music in the churches, is this what we're going to hear in heaven? I certainly don't think that a lot of this honors God, but I'd like your opinion on that, and we'll be back in just a moment with Dave Talbot. And, of course, we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Dave Talbot, who is with Mount Hermon. And for those of you who are across the country, don't know much about the Monterey Bay area of California, Mount Hermon is a summer camp. It's a camp where people come to from all over the country, really all over the world, for meetings. They have conventions, wonderful Christian meetings and conventions, and usually wonderful Christian music there. Mr. Talbot works there. Are you involved in music at Mount Hermon?
I am. My title is actually Director of Adult Ministries, but I also program our concert series, which we have in the summer, our Saturday night concert series, and we also do 8 concerts at Christmas time, and I program and host those, and I also program the morning worship service that we have in the summer, which is open to the public, just as in the summer months. Then the rest of the year I'm involved at my local church or on weekend conferences occasionally. So I get involved with music. I don't have the title of director of music because each programmer is allowed to decide who's going to do the music for their own conference.
Well, now, of course, as I was commenting, we seem to find the music getting increasingly, at least certain of the music, getting increasingly loud and really emphasizing a beat. And, of course, that beat, I believe, has really a tremendous impact on the individual. I think that, you know, the traditional, there'll be a rhythm and there'll be a melody and a rhythm there and a harmony. But some of this modern music really, of course, is very, very grating and offensive. And yet, of course, the young people seem to like this because they get an adrenaline rush with it, because it really does impact on their soul. But I really wonder if it's an influence of good or of evil.
Well, that's the $64,000 question, I guess, and that's where the worship wars come in. Then people argue about these things endlessly. And there are some churches, even here in the local Santa Cruz area, that have gone to all contemporary music, and their attendance has shot way up, and they say, see, that's justifying what we're doing. I'm not sure that's always the sole reason. Just because they went to contemporary music, I think personality and pastoral leadership has something to do, has a great deal to do with it too.
But of course, is numbers really how God honors a church or looks to a church for success?
No, but when it comes down to a vote on the board of directors or elders or deacons or trustees or whatever you call them in your local church, and they're talking about what's working, and there's a perception that the contemporary music works at attracting new people, then it's hard to vote against that, I presume.
Hold that thought for just a moment here as our other stations join us. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest this evening is David Talbot, who works at Mount Hermon here in the north shore of Monterey Bay. And, of course, we're talking about the influence of contemporary music in the church. Do you think that you get a real emotional response to music? In other words, certainly that we're talking about this rather loud beat music in the church that is being used, and of course it draws people in. But are they coming in your estimation, for the right reason or for the wrong reason?
Well, I'm not sure that music is the total draw for everybody or even a majority of people, but we have convinced ourselves that is a major reason, and so that's why churches have decided to go all contemporary, for example, or maybe blended music, where they do some traditional music and blend it with the contemporary music. And I guess I have less trouble with that, because then you are not making style the king of your worship. You're going thematically perhaps more, which I vote for. But it's hard to say that people come into a church and are attracted to it just because of music. There would be a certain element of perhaps the younger generation that would be true. I suppose you could start a church based on Dixieland music, Dixieland band style, or big band style. If you did all big band style and announced that that's all you were doing, you'd get a certain element of people who would come out just for that. You take somebody as well known as Chuck Swindoll, and who's now in Texas, used to be in California for years and years. He's built a huge church on his preaching ability, but also he insists that there be a good blended style and that it would not go all contemporary by any stretch of the means. And there's lots of churches you could cite in California and across the country that are taking that stance. And I find also, I don't travel that much to the far east coast of our country, but when I have done that, I find that the music is much more conservative in the east than it is in the west. California is probably the biggest melting pot of musical styles, and more use of hard, what I'd even call hard rock music in some worship. Most people would say it's a softer rock and a light contemporary, but there's all kinds of styles. And there's no question that the loudness and the beat drives some people away, but on the other hand, I don't think you can deny that it does attract some people. And the question is, how can you get a balance that doesn't alienate some people? And I think that can be done. And that comes back to the question of the education of our ministers of music and worship leaders. They can do a much better job if they've got the broader educational background, but I find that lacking in an awful lot of churches, especially the churches that have sprung up and been overnight sensations. They have tended to just use the people that have that are available rather than that have the educational background.
All right, fine. Well, of course, now when we're talking about music, what do you think has the most impact on people? The melody, the beat, the loudness, the harmony? What is it that really allows it to have a psychological impact on people?
Well, that's a hard thing to pin down, and if you took 100 people in a room and polled them real carefully, you'd probably get 100 different interpretations of it. And as Marshall McLuhan used to say, the medium is the message. It's not any one thing. It's the whole package. And so it's hard to say that just the beat is influencing or wrong or good or just the melody line. But I do find that in contemporary music, melody lines are very hard to follow. They're not predictable. And there's almost a studied effort to make them not predictable in the name of being contemporary. And so you'll find songs that just wander all over, and it takes the worship team a lot of effort to teach a new song because the congregation can't get the feel of it readily, and particularly since we've gone back to the oral tradition, which is the great irony in church music today. You know, Gutenberg finally gave us the ability to print music, and hymnals came into great use in the late 1800s and early 1900s in this country. And millions and millions and millions were printed, and churches and congregants had the ability to read music, to make a wonderful harmonies, and stay together in a meaningful manner that was worshipful. Now, with the advent of the overhead projector and then a PowerPoint and all the other things that have come along now, we've gone back to abandoning anything in print, and that forces us to mostly just sing the melody. And when the melody is unpredictable and difficult to the Western ear and the traditionally trained ear, it really, I think, puts a damper on worship. And the funny thing I discover when I go to a church that is using mostly contemporary music and then they insert a traditional hymn, the participation level goes way up. You insert Amazing Grace or To God Be the Glory or Fairest Lord Jesus or any of the grand hymns of the faith, invariably the audience comes alive much more with those and sings much more wholeheartedly. And that's an overgeneralization, I'm sure, but I've observed this an awful lot when I'm visiting in churches, and I visit a lot because I'm out on the road doing concerts and representing Mount Hermon, so I get exposure to in the last 20 years I've probably been to several hundred churches and their different styles of music. So I think I've got a fair statement that when the traditional music is included, you get a better response because people know it and it's easier to sing. And when you make contemporary music difficult to sing, it mitigates against the worship experience because you're so wrapped up in trying to figure out where we are that you don't get the worship experience.
And of course, the point that you're making, I'd never thought of this before, but what you're saying is that ordinarily when you construct a song, there's a consistency to the melody, and there's a you can sort of feel where it's going to go next, even if you haven't heard it before. But with these new songs, they have almost taken that out, almost as if they're trying to confuse you.
Right, and some of that. And the other alternative is to make it simplistic and repetitive so you finally get the point across, and so you repeat and repeat and repeat. And when you do that week after week with a local congregation, you can teach music. The thing I have difficulty with at the Mount Hermon Christian Conference Center is that on any given Sunday, we may have 80 to 100 different churches represented in the public sitting out there in the pews, and so I've got a little different task. And have to be a little bit more careful of what I attempt to do because I don't have them Sunday by Sunday. Every Sunday the crowd has changed, and so we have some unusual challenges here at Mount Hermon and trying to be all things to all men. But the local church does have the advantage of being able to teach its congregation, and so that's an advantage. But I still find much of contemporary music very hard to follow. and the example I cited a few minutes ago, Jack Hayford's Majesty, at least there's a little repetition to that and a little sense of order to that. And there are a lot of contemporary songs that that are not hard to sing and not difficult at all. But I was just in a worship experience this very week where I could not figure out what was happening. I did not know the songs. We had a visitor who had not been part of our situation before, and he assumed we all knew what he knew, and we were struggling to follow because it was back to the oral tradition and no music in front of us and just trying to listen to the leaders and to mimic, and I think we've gone backwards in this. I think it's one of the greatest ironies of all of our incredible technology that we've gone back to the way our great-great-great-grandparents used to learn music, and that was the oral tradition. You just stand there and listen to what goes on up front and try to mimic it or echo it. But what a shame that we've given up reading music. And, of course, our schools have totally abandoned, almost totally abandoned, any kind of music education. I think that's coming back to bite our culture, too. When my kids, who have been out of school now for 15 years or so, were in school, their total music education was a young lady coming by with a guitar once a week for 1 hour, and in junior high and grade school, and singing songs like Michael Row the Boat Ashore and We Shall Overcome, and that was their music education. And that's a far cry from the way we used to be trained in school in the old days. I think a lot of that is, in California at least, is due to the effects of Proposition 13. And, of course, now that's spread across the country. As everybody is squeezed for dollars, the first thing that goes is the arts. And that's coming back to bite us. And this gives a great opportunity for the church to jump into the educational process. And I am seeing some good hope here, where churches are starting after-school schools of music. And we have some good examples of that right here in Santa Cruz County. I just talked to a minister of music this week who's thinking of starting one here in the area too. So there is some hope, but the church has blown a great opportunity to be educators in this area, and I think it'll be a great day if we can get back to that more.
Well, because I love the beautiful old songs, and I was in a meeting this last weekend where there were people from all across the country, and certainly the song leader got up and took three or four old songs for all these people. We didn't have the music, we didn't have the words, but the people knew the songs and were able to sing them because
yep.
they'd been brought up with that. And what they've done is really sort of remove our traditions. They've come up with this new music. It's confusing. Some of it is very offensive to me personally. I'm sure that to many of the young people who've been raised on hard rock, this is attractive to them, because I think that people actually get an adrenaline rush from the music, from the beat. But I don't think that that necessarily honors our Lord. Now, maybe I'm just old-fashioned. I'm 75, so I'm a little older than you are. But I like the traditions of Christianity as it was, rather than the new religion as we seem to be going. There was nothing wrong with the old music, but of course we've simply abandoned it, as everything in society seems to be changing.
Yeah. Well, and there were some legitimate reasons to abandon some music. I mean, in the minds of the people who came through the 60s and 70s, they didn't like the these and thous of traditional church music, and we don't talk like that in everyday language. Why should we sing our praises to God with these, thous, and wouldst? And so that's understandable, that there's an attempt to contemporize our language and worship, but with that came the total swing of the pendulum over to the contemporary music, not just the lyrics. So we have a double whammy there of both the lyrics and the music becoming totally contemporized.
All right, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. If you're out across America listening to us, I'd like to know what you think about the discussion on music. And I wonder what part the music has played in changing our society and changing our values. Certainly, if you go back and you read what Plato and Aristotle wrote about music, they felt that this was vitally important as far as society, and there were certain music that inflamed the passions and would lead to disruption of society. And they felt that staid and proper music with a proper rhythm and just the way it was presented would have a wonderful impact and, of course, cause to or stimulate people to higher levels of being good citizens. They felt that good music and good citizenship went together. And, of course, I think that many people down through the centuries over the last 2,000 years have believed that music could be used to create almost a revolutionary change in society. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Well, yeah, that'd be maybe a little hard to prove. Again, because of our diverse culture, we're such a melting pot of styles and interests and so many immigrants, and our whole country's built on immigrants, and so I just that's a hard thing to say, and to say what is proper music, you know, what you decide is proper may not be proper in my mind, and certainly not proper in the mind of a 30-year-old composer trying to figure out something for this coming Sunday's worship service. So we've got ourselves in a bit of a fix here, but I take a little comfort in sensing that the pendulum is swinging back a little bit more towards traditional. I mean, it's a slow movement, but I'm seeing it more and more. I see it in the kind of invitations I'm getting as a concert performer. I've performed piano concerts for years and years out on the road in churches and whatnot, and now I'm getting asked to lead hymn sings, and we have a hymn sing at Mount Hermon 5-6 times a year that attract hundreds of people, and that we just sing the great hymns of the faith for an hour. We don't use drums, we don't use even the overhead projector, we use a hymnal, and people just flock to it. And what I get is I'm saying goodbye to people one after another, saying we don't get this in our churches anymore, they've abandoned. They didn't even abandon the standard piano, let alone the organ. All we get is drums and thumping. I hear this long litany of negative concerns about what has happened in churches, and that's why they're coming out to these hymn sings. And then now, when I get invitations to do concerts, they almost always are saying, well, how would you like to lead us in a hymn sing? Do some concert music, too, but we mainly want you to come and do a hymn sing. And I'd say that is... In the last 5 years, that has just changed dramatically, and it's the church's attempt to service that segment of their congregations that are saying to the pastoral leadership, you've got to give us more traditional music. We cannot abandon it totally, and so that's one way they're finding to do is to bring in somebody like myself who can do that kind of thing because they don't feel they have the local leadership to do it as well. So,
well, let's go to Barbara, who's calling in. Barbara, did you have a question or comment?
Well, Dave mentioned something that I was going to say, that the hymn sings at Mount Hermon are absolutely wonderful. I have been privileged to attend them, and, people, really should take advantage of them when they can. And we are really privileged to have a church who sings the hymns and does not go into the contemporary music, and for that I am eternally grateful. But I have one question. Is when you hear music that people call Christian, and the music is, frankly, rock music with lyrics that you really can't understand, how do you feel about this?
What, you mean if you're just listening to music and you can't understand?
Yeah, somebody says, this is Christian music, and I'm listening to it, and this music is actually making me angry, and I don't understand the words.
And you're hearing this on radio?
I'm hearing this in just various places that I go, and people are saying this is Christian music.
Yeah, well,
that was one of the
early objections to contemporary music, is you couldn't understand what was being sung,
right.
And the music being sung on secular radio too, you can't even understand it in that level either.
Just what makes it Christian if you don't understand what is being said?
Yeah,
and it also is actually making you. Having a feeling of anger welling up inside you, well, it does this. It's, this is not to me Christianity, a Christian feeling.
You hang on there. We'll just see if we can get an answer for that. And Kirk, you hang on too. All right, Dr. Stan back here, I guess Dave Talbot. Do you have any other comments, Barbara?
No, that's all. I just wanted to know what his feelings were.
Not being able to understand the music you're listening to is too bad. And the younger generation says, okay, we understand it. Well, that's maybe because they're listening with headphones and the vast repetition of hearing things over and over and over, they learn to be able to get it. But I don't think there's any excuse for not being able to understand music that is performed in any setting. So that's a concern. Sure, you need to be able to understand what's being sung if you want to get anything out of it.
Okay, fine. Thanks so much, Barbara.
Okay,
let's go
you.
To Kurt calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Kurt.
Hello. Perhaps your guest and I should get together. I'm a concert artist myself on saxophone. Oh, we worked in a large church in San Jose in the early 70s. I used to keep 25 churches in Christmas and Easter orchestras. Finding Christian musicians, I have a very extensive file. It took me a long time, and by the way, I was playing in a Pentecostal church, large one, and their music was country gospel, which I wasn't particularly fond of, but I was fond of seeing 100 people accept Christ every Sunday.
Mm.
That was exciting.
Yeah.
And I ran a big band on the youth programs. We saw 12 to 1,500 kids accept Christ in a year and a half, and that was exciting. But, you know, whatever the form of music, it's bad, that's another story. But the thing is, you know, where did Christian music, or how did Christian music, at least in this area, get to the state it's at? In the 70s, I spent years training churches to pay musicians. They pay them $5 a session, or $15. You know, we eventually got them up where they were paying $50. Union scale at the time was about $65. But there was a great deal of people who didn't know about music, that weren't trained people like we are, weren't professional musicians, and they were running the music in the churches. And frankly, they were not polite, shall we say, to the musicians. And I saw dozens and dozens of professional musicians get turned off by the way they were treated in the churches and go their own way and play where they were treated like ladies and gentlemen. And I think the churches, through their cheapness and through their lack of professionalism, and politics and other things, have turned off the musicians, the good ones, and driven them out of the churches. And I think that the churches today are lost because they have this vast talent pool that, frankly, they're not very fond of.
Hmm.
So I think that's a lot of your answer. And
okay.
It's one nobody ever brings up.
All right. Any thoughts on that? We're just about out of time.
Well, we're here to lead people to Christ.
Amen to that.
We ought to do that.
Thanks very much, Kurt.
Yep, I know.
And I want to thank you so very much, Dave, for being with us this evening. It's been a fascinating time.
My pleasure.
God bless you, and maybe one of these times we'll have a chance to meet you out there at Mount River.
Hey.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, we wanted you to hear views of a professional musician on what's happening to the music of our churches. I am very concerned that music is being used intentionally to disrupt the contemporary beliefs. Many years ago, I used to read the communist publications on a regular basis, and I'll never forget, it was in about 1963 or 1964, reading on the front page of the communist newspaper saying, don't knock rock and roll. And it said, with every beat of the music, we draw closer to the revolution. And, of course, I believe that certain of this music can be used to influence the very heart and mind and souls of people, not only, of course, at the general youth, but I think it can also have a profound impact in the church. And I'm very concerned that we've gotten off on the wrong road. But that's my opinion. If you'd like more information from people a lot smarter than I am, we have a four-tape set called Musical Madness. That's Musical Madness. And, of course, if you have not yet read Dr. Carson Holloway's book, All Shook Up, going into the history of music, going back to Plato and Aristotle, I think this is an excellent source of information. And if you'd like to call us, we can tell you how to get that book. Carson Holloway's book, Dr. Carson Holloway, All Shook Up, The History of Music, starting with Plato and Aristotle, what they wrote about music, and tragically, they just don't teach this in schools anymore. Well, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you who listen to our program to help us as we reach out 5 hours every weekday, and of course to about 35 stations with our weekend program, trying to get people to understand what's going on. We have about 60 outlets all told. And if you believe, as I do, that America is on the verge of destruction, you'd like to become part of our team as we reach out with the news behind the news, the story behind the story, why, give us a call. 1-800-544-8927. We'd be glad to send you information on our ministry. Be glad to send you our February newsletter, which tells you what really happened on the morning of September 11th, when Dick Cheney was in the Presidential Emergency Operating Center, there, the bunker underneath the White House, as they monitored the plane that was coming in to strike the Pentagon. Testimony by Norman Mineta. You'll never read it in the newspaper. We quote it, and we'll give you the sources where you can check it out as well. Quite a different story than you've heard from Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly and Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw. We hope you'll go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our programs 5 hours a day there. Learn how to listen to our programs 4 hours a day on the shortwave. Please tell others about our programs, because people all across America may not be where we have a regular station, but of course they can always hear us on shortwave, or they can always hear our programs on the internet. And of course, if you miss the program, you can always pull it down off of the archives. And our plea is, help us reach other people. Try to get them to listen to the programs. Pull down our newsletters, copy those, hand them out. You can copy any of our 4 tape set, any of the videos we've made. The major thing is to reach the people. And remember, of course, we encourage people to get my video, The Best Enemies Money Can Buy. After all, we need to know who financed the North Vietnamese. Maybe we'd be better able to understand who's financing Al-Qaeda today. That's The Best Enemy Money Can Buy, my interview with Professor Sutton back in 1980, or his book, The Best Enemies Money Can Buy, cost him his position at the Hoover Institute when he testified before the Republican Convention back in 1972. But at least he told the truth. And then, of course, our video, The Brotherhood of Darkness, Diaprax in the Church, The Story of the Church Growth Movement, Megiddo, The March to Armageddon, all available by calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Of course, when you request a free copy of my newsletter. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and ministers. But please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening, when we'll be back with you once again, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.